Good morning. I'm Mike Orr, as he said, and I work for Creation Ministries International part-time. I'm mainly a researcher in the earth sciences, but I'm an adjunct speaker for Creation Ministries International, CMI, which is a faith-based information and equipping ministry supported almost totally by donations. CMI is located in 7 countries. It's an international ministry. And they've been publishing Creation Magazine for 33 years and the Journal of Creation for 25 years. And I'll start off with a little information on a few of the resources we have. We have the website. Whoops, didn't want that yet. Creation.com. This website has 8,000 articles on it, believe it or not. Thank you. I'm not too used to heat. It's been kind of cool in Bozeman for a while. Anyway, if you have questions you can't answer, or you want to do some research, get the website. And you know, it's easy to remember, creation.com. We have some little cards back at the book table on it. We also have a free online newsletter called InfoBytes. I'll tell you more about this in the main service. What this is an alert, an online alert to let you know about things that come up in the culture, you know, hot topics. Like, say, they found the missing link in Africa. You know, you'll get an alert. And there'll be a one-paragraph discussion of that. For more information, you go to the website. That's what that's about. And I also talked about new resources and specials. We also publish Creation Magazine. How many here get Creation Magazine? Oh, about 6 or 7 of you. Good. I'll tell you more about that in the main service. Anyway, my topic is whatever happened to the woolly mammoths. The point of this, the relevance of this, which I'll mention right now before I forget, is that with our worldview, the creation worldview, and in the scientific data, we can solve mysteries out there that they've been unable to explain for well over 100 years. One of these is the Ice Age, which I'll talk about in the main service. And from the Ice Age, we have the woolly mammoths that lived during the Ice Age. Also, and this is an area I've been studying for almost 40 years now, and so this is going to be about the woolly mammoths. You know, those woolly mammoths in Siberia. What is a woolly mammoth? Well, it's essentially a hairy elephant. It has, you know, curved tusks. It has a hump on its head and a hump on its back, and its back slopes down more than the average elephant. It's kind of similar to the Asian elephant in a lot of ways. In fact, they did find a type of Asian elephant about 20 years ago, someplace, I forgot, Burma, that had a lot of similarities to woolly mammoths, minus the hair. Of course, the woolly mammoth has 3 types of hairs. The outer hair is almost a meter long, or about 3 feet long. And has short ears also. A lot of adaptations to the cold. That's a woolly mammoth. And I'm going to focus this in Siberia, in Alaska, in the Yukon, up there in the north, where they're in the permafrost. So I'm going to talk about the mysteries. There's lots of mysteries up there. First of all, they found bones and tusks in the permafrost, which is permanently frozen ground. How did they get there? Also, they noticed that they were generally well preserved, which means they had to be buried rapidly to be preserved. Then they discovered frozen carcasses where you had sometimes all the flesh still there, and they had the stomach contents half digested, and they can analyze the plants at last ate. And so, you know, how did that all happen? And how did they get into the permafrost? How did that carcass get into the permafrost? And so it implies it was rapidly frozen. So how does all that happen? And a quote from Henry Howorth, who wrote about this in the 1800s, he said, By no physical process known to us can we understand how soft flesh could be buried in ground while it's frozen as hard as flint without disintegrating it. We cannot push an elephant's body into a mass of solid ice or hard frozen gravel and clay without entirely destroying the fine articulations and pounding the whole mass into jelly. nor would we fail in greatly disturbing the ground in the process. So the point is, how do you get this carcass or even the bones into the permafrost? That's one of the major mysteries of the woolly mammoths in Siberia. I'll mainly mention Siberia, but it also applies to the lowlands of Alaska and the lowlands of the Yukon Territory of Canada. So are we talking about a huge number of mammoths or just a few? If it's just a few, it's just an accident that they got up there. Well, to discover this, I went to the experts, the Russian experts, to do the research. And they say there's millions of them. There's millions of them that are buried still in the permafrost. And the further north you go, the more there are. And they're concentrated especially along the Arctic Ocean and some islands off the shore of the New Siberian Islands. They're really concentrated there. There's millions of them. And then one stretch, 600-mile stretch between two rivers, this guy Nikolay Vereshchagin estimated about 6 million mammoths still there in the permafrost. So we're talking about a major mystery of science, not some little tiny accident that you don't have to worry about. But there's even more Siberian mysteries. Not only do you have the woolly mammoth, you have a wide diversity of other animals, a woolly rhinoceros, all kinds of rams. You had burrowing mammals, you know, and beavers. You know, they don't live up there today. The burrowing mammals like ferrets and badgers. Also, most of these mammals ate grass. They were grazers. But the vegetation up there is bog vegetation, which is toxic to grazers. So what gives? Also, wildlife specialists would consider these healthy animals, well-dressed giants, hairy coats, big horns. Most of these animals went extinct at the end of the Ice Age. Why did that happen? In fact, they not only went extinct up there, most of them went extinct all over the earth. And some of the mammals now live further south. It's just not a congenial environment up there now. So from what we know about these animals up there, we can infer this. These are deductions from Siberia, the environment that they lived in. It had to be a grassland with a wide diversity of plants. This is totally unlike the area today. It's a bogland because it has permafrost, permanently frozen ground that melts only a foot or two in the summer. And then it has nowhere to drain, so it just stays on the surface. So it's a great bogland with bog vegetation. So the soil it had to be fertile back then, unlike the bog vegetation today. It had to be a high-quality habitat with a large variety of grasses to meet the needs of all these types of animals. Also, competition had to be light. Also, a long growing season. Now, does that sound like a radically different environment and climate from what we have up there today? It is. Also, some more deductions. The snowfall has to be light and melt early. You had milder, relatively dry winters. Summer bogs had to be rare. And the summer bogs are caused by the permafrost, which means little or no permafrost until the end of the Ice Age. Now, they believe permafrost has been up there for millions of years. So how in the world no permafrost? So these deductions are major radical differences compared to Siberia today. And some more evidence that there is little or no permafrost at the beginning of the Ice Age is the recent and Ice Age distribution of the Saiga antelope. The solid line, let's see if my cursor works, is the distribution right now of the Saiga antelope. The dashed line is the historical distribution, but these dots are the Ice Age distribution. So you can see they were well up in Siberia, northern Siberia. Here's the New Siberian Island where you have thousands of woolly mammoth buried in the permafrost up in here. And even in the lowlands of Alaska, northern Alaska, and even the along the coast of the Yukon Territory. The interesting thing about Saiga antelopes, they have small hooves, and they can't negotiate permafrost. So this implies wide open spaces with no permafrost, which is a radically different environment. Permafrost is formed by cold winter temperatures. You cool from the top down, and it gets further and further down as you go. Is this micro? Am I? I've noticed I'm moving around. Is it? Are you hearing me all right? Okay. But there's even more mysteries. Not the end. Some bones and carcasses are found in a generally standing upright position, as if they sank in a bog. But unfortunately, there's no bog vegetation, or very rarely do you have bog vegetation around the carcass or skeleton. So they were covered up and buried by some other material. And that's the key to the mysteries, as I will get into. Five animals suffocated based on the condition of the blood. And two woolly rhinos and three woolly mammoths were suffocated. How did they suffocate? They also have broken bones. The Barasavaca mammoth has, which I'll show you a picture of, has a broken forelimb and has a broken ribs and broken pelvis. How do you break the pelvis of an animal like that? Those are some of the big mysteries. And the New Siberian Islands have a huge amount of bones on them. Now, how did they get out there? I'll get into all this. And the lowlands of Siberia, as well as Alaska and the Yukon Territory, were never glaciated. Well, when they run their models of glaciation, those are some of the first places that glaciate. These are some of the major mysteries of the Ice Age, by the way. And it's because they have the wrong model, of course. Okay, let's have a quote by another Russian researcher who published in the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society in 1929. Now, Brandt, who is a Siberian explorer, says this: he was very much impressed by the fact that remnants of the mammoth carcasses and skeletons alike sometimes were found posed, which indicates that the animal had perished standing upright as though they had bogged. So that's a quote indicating, and here's a picture of the Barasavaca mammoth as it was found in that generally standing position. Here's a picture of the Selurican horse. They find a lot of horses and bisons. In Alaska, they find mainly, especially bisons and less woolly mammoths. Siberia, it's mainly mammoths and less horses and bisons. Anyway, this is how they discovered it in a gold mine. They discovered its hooves hanging down from the ceiling of the gold mine. So they put their lamps on it to light their way in the gold mine. And so the researchers found out about this and dug it up. And it was under 26 feet of debris. And this is Dale Guthrie of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks' idea on how he think they died. Well, the horse got stuck in a bog. Up to its neck. Oh, by the way, it was headless. So it sunk up to its head. And then a cave lion, which was one of the inhabitants of Siberia, ate off its head. And then you had debris covered it up to 26 feet. So that's how Dale Guthrie explains it. So it's in a generally standing position, except in this case, I don't believe it's bog vegetation around it. And here is a plot of where it was glaciated during the Ice Age, just the mountains of Siberia and Alaska, the Brooks Range of Alaska. See if my cursor's showing up. Yeah. Brooks Range of Alaska and the Alaska Range, but the lowlands of Alaska where the woolly mammoths are found, it was never glaciated. Same with Siberia, especially northeast Siberia is mountainous. And then in the Ice Age, if the sea level dropped at 100 meters, I don't think it dropped near that far, but anyway, if it dropped 100 meters, all this area would be exposed, all the continental shelf. And you find all kinds of mammoth skeletons on the continental shelf out in here in the Bering Sea, and even on some of the islands right along the edge of the continental shelf out in there, you find some woolly mammoth skeletons. So indicating that they were all, a lot of them were on the continental shelves when the sea level was lower, when you piled up ice on the land. And here's a quote from the Journal of Creation about the mystery of why the lowlands were not glaciated. Siberia, Alaska, and the Yukon, including the lowlands, were among the first to glaciate in Uniformitarian Ice Age. UNIF dot stands for Uniformitarian. That's the alternative view of using present processes to explain all the past rocks, fossils, and even the past climate. And they said, we now have glaciation, but mainly outside the area where it existed during the last Ice Age. Oh, no. By the way, it's hard for these models to produce an ice age. You've got to tweak the models a lot to produce an ice age. But unfortunately for this model, when they do tweak it and get one, it's in the wrong spots. So woolly mammoth extinction is a major mystery of mainstream earth science. I have several quotes, and I'm only going to have time for one. No, I have time for more than that. Okay. Peter Ward, in The Call of the Distant Mammoth, says this: this great extinction, truly a mass extinction, yeah, on the level of the dinosaurs, represents one of paleontology's most fundamental mysteries. So this is a major mystery. And it's still a mystery. And so the point is, can our worldview, our model of the flood and the ice age, explain this? And I'm saying indeed it does, indicating that our model is superior and our model is based on the Bible, which means we can trust the Bible. Oh, here's another quote from Larry Agenbrod and Lisa Nelson. Larry Agenbrod is the chief U.S. expert on woolly mammoths, or mammoths in general. There's also the Colombian mammoth, which is a lot larger and lived further south during the Ice Age. In fact, you probably find a lot of them in New Mexico. You probably find there's Colombian mammoths, in fact, with evidence of spear points in New Mexico. Anyway, why did mammoths disappear from the earth? This question remains one of the great unsolved mysteries of the past. There's generally three categories of extinction hypotheses. The uniformitarian, which is the standard mainstream explanation. And then there's some non-creation catastrophists, which I used to talk about, but don't anymore because I found out when I do polls that hardly anyone's ever heard of these guys, so there's no point of going into it. And then there's us, creationists. And we have two hypotheses. One, actually there's a third, which is not believed by too many, but they generally come into two main hypotheses. One, by a quick freeze early in the flood. And secondly, at the end of the post-flood rapid ice age. So we're divided on this issue. So if you read any creationist material you'll find two different ideas out there. And you've already, from what I've said, know where I stand. I go with number B, but I will go into why I don't believe A. And then I'll explain why B can explain all the data. Anyway, the uniformitarian hypotheses, they essentially downplay the number of mammoths. I've heard some say maybe 75,000. These are U.S. people. But you go to the Russian experts, and they'll tell you there's millions there. And they grudgingly say maybe it's a little warmer during an interglacial. But that won't help them much because we're in an interglacial now. See, we're still in the ice age cycles. You have a glaciation, interglacial, and it's been repeated 50 times in the last 2.6 million years in their time scale. So there have been many ice ages, they claim. I'll get into that in the main presentation. So they grudgingly say maybe it's a little warmer, but that won't help them. How will that? That'll just melt the permafrost a little deeper. That permafrost is 1,000 feet deep or more in a lot of areas, so the summer bogs won't go away. They can't live up there. An elephant or a woolly mammoth was essentially a hairy elephant. They couldn't live up there today. So that's a big problem. Some say, but it was much colder during a glacial phase, and that would freeze all the bogs all the time. But then there's the problem, what are they going to eat if everything's frozen all year round? So, you know, they really are clueless. And I don't think they've really put their mind on this. Here's a quote from the literature. William Ferrand in Science says, "The woolly mammoth data can be adequately explained by the everyday processes which we can observe around us." You know, I don't think they've faced the real data up there. Dale Guthrie, the University of Alaska, a uniformitarian scientist, comes the closest. So a lot of the material I've gotten, like on the environment, comes from him, which he's pretty close, but because he's a uniformitarian, he misses it as a result. So they have three main problems, the uniformitarians. Why would they live in Siberia today? Winters are bitterly cold and dark. And the boggy land in summer, they could never get around in the summer. And then what would they eat in the wintertime? There's no green vegetation until July. And bog vegetation is toxic. And, of course, how did they all die and become buried in that permafrost? So these are some major issues that they have, and they have not really faced because they've stuck like glue to their worldview. And they have not considered ours. And when you consider what an elephant needs every day, which essentially a woolly mammoth is very similar to an elephant, they need 400 to 650 pounds of feed a day and 35 to 50 gallons of water a day. And if there's millions of them, where are they going to get all that up there today if it was similar to today? So they have major problems. And like I said, we have two creationist hypotheses, and I'm going to explain why I don't believe number A there. The idea of a quick freeze early in the flood is the idea that it mainly comes from Walt Brown, and he has an idea which to me is totally unworkable meteorologically and physically, where you shoot up all this water up in space and it cools and comes down as muddy hail and buries the woolly mammoths early in the flood, right at the very beginning of the flood. And the quick freeze is the temperature falls down to minus 150 degrees Fahrenheit below zero instantly. So the idea is you got this woolly mammoth out there peacefully eating grass in a fairly warm environment. And buttercups, and the reason we have the buttercups is you find those in their stomach and sometimes in their mouth. And then wham, 150 degrees Fahrenheit below zero freezes them right in their tracks and all the other animals. That's the idea of the quick freeze. By the way, the idea of the quick freeze is a reasonable idea. And it was actually started by uniformitarians, Georges Cuvier, a French paleontologist in the early 1800s. It was his idea, and it was a reasonable idea, except there's a lot of problems against it. First of all, the woolly mammoths just didn't live up there in Siberia, Alaska, and the Yukon. They were essentially from France all the way into the U.S. They were essentially where it was not glaciated, clear across the northern hemisphere. They're part of a northern hemisphere grassland environmental group of animals. So why focus just on Siberia for the quick freeze? Why not quick freeze them in the U.S., for instance, or in France? So that they don't go there. They only focus a quick freeze on Siberia, Alaska, and the Yukon, where they're in the permafrost. Also, they're drawn on cave walls in the Ural Mountains, and caves and cave art is post-flood, you see. So these people that lived in caves during the Ice Age, which is a great place to live during the Ice Age, by the way, they left a lot of art, and they drew woolly mammoths. So obviously woolly mammoths are Ice Age animals. And they're generally absent from glaciated areas, which, if they're not associated with the Ice Age, should not be. Also, their bones are on top of glacial debris called glacial till. That till is the term they use for glacial debris in northwest Siberia. So after the ice melted in northwest Siberia, the woolly mammoths came up in that area, and then they died on top of the glacial debris. So that tells you they died at the end of the Ice Age, does it not? Also, if they buried in the flood, early in the flood, they'd be at the bottom of the sedimentary rocks, you see. But no, they're on the top of unconsolidated sediments that are frozen. So they're where they shouldn't be. They're not at the bottom of the sedimentary rocks. And there's thick sedimentary rocks in Siberia. And there's the usual ones you see around here like limestone, and there's coal and things of this nature. And they're not found at the bottom of the sedimentary rocks. Here's the woolly mammoth distribution. Like I said, it goes from the Atlantic Ocean all around the unglaciated areas of the northern hemisphere. Now, it is in the periphery of glaciated areas, and that could be either before it was glaciated or as the ice sheets melted back, they ended up there. But in the interior of places glaciated like North America and Scandinavia, you don't find their skeletons. And it has there's quite a wide distribution here. They're even found in the, like I said, the continental shelves out in here in the Bering Sea and Strait. They're found off the Atlantic coast. They're found in the Sea of Japan, right in there. And they're found by the thousands, if not tens of thousands, on the bottom of the North Sea. So they're widely distributed, but not associated with the Ice Age. And here's a little picture from my wife and I children's book of a caveman, quote, was probably more intelligent than us. spending some spare time drawing mammoths on cave walls. And they're drawn, like I said, right next to Western Siberia in the Ural Mountains. So they saw them in Siberia after during the Ice Age. So that's evidence that they against them dying in the flood. What about the quick freeze idea? Well, I think, like I said, it's reasonable. And I think you have to have a moderately quick freeze, but not down to 150 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. I believe that's impossible. So there's evidence against a quick freeze, that they were frozen right in their tracks instantly. First of all, the number of carcasses are very small. Of the millions of mammoths up there, there's only less than 100 carcasses. Less than 100. So there's actually a small number of carcasses, which can be explained by unusual circumstances. The general case of how they died and buried, you know, the flesh decayed and they were buried somehow and interred in the permafrost. That takes time. So the fact that you don't have flesh on too many indicates natural death and burial. But fairly fast burial because the bones and tusks are in fairly good condition. Also, there's also partial decay of these carcasses. You might have heard statements that that woolly mammoths are found in ice. Actually, they're not found in ice. They're found in sediments with a lot of ice wedges and ice lenses. That's permafrost features. Also, you might have heard that people have eaten mammoth steaks. That's also untrue. Dogs have eaten mammoth meat. But when you thaw this meat out, it stinks. It's partially decayed. So that takes time. They weren't frozen instantly. Also, you find flies have already laid eggs in these carcasses because you find them in the skeletons and in the carcasses after they thaw out. So it's not, well, they're sitting on the ground today and thawed out, the flies got on them. It was when they were sitting there right after they died. Also, when you examine the vegetation in their stomach that's half digested, it comes from different seasons by the state of the vegetation. Some died in winter, some died in spring. You know, if it was a quick freeze, it would be all at the same time, you see, the same season, so it would be the same state of decay. Also, we have U.S. mastodons, mainly in the northeast part, in bogs, found in old bogs that are now peat. We find their stomach contents that are partially digested only, or partially decayed. And no one suggests that mastodons underwent a quick freeze at any time. So there's something more to this story, which I will tell you more about as I get into the solutions of these mysteries. So how can the post-flood ice age account for the mammoths? You know, they died at the end of the they lived during the ice age, they died at the end of the ice age all over the world. So how can the post-flood ice age account for them? Well, here's a quick little summary of the ice age I'm going to talk about in the next service. Anyway, the ice age was caused by warm oceans right after the flood, which caused huge evaporation and volcanic ash and aerosols, reflecting sunlight back to space, cooling the land. So you have a cooling mechanism for the summer, and you have a huge amount of moisture, just what you need for the ice age, and you have a quick dump of snow and ice on the ground for the ice age. So, and based on the cooling time of the ocean, which I'll get into, you can estimate how long the ice age took. They claim each ice age takes 100,000 years. But based on different assumptions, we can time it to within 500 years to reach glacial maximum, about. And actually, I used ranges in the variables. I'll go into this in more detail later. This is just a quickie overview of the ice age. And then the thickness of the ice was about an average of 2,300 feet in northern hemisphere, and about 4,000 feet Antarctica. And it melts quickly, about an average of 33 feet a year on the edge, and less in the interior. So the total time it takes to melt is about 200 years. The total time for the ice age is around 700 years. These are rough estimates, by the way, because we weren't there. I have to estimate what the conditions were like. But I'll get into this later. But the point of all this is I want to focus in on the climate of Siberia. Now, at the end of the flood, the water would be warm from top to bottom and pole to pole. And the significance of this is there would be no sea ice. The Arctic Ocean would be warm, maybe 80 degrees Fahrenheit. You could take a swim in the Arctic Ocean right after the flood. And the significance of that is you have a huge amount of evaporation. You heat the air up. So a guy ran a model, a computer model, and the only thing he did was take off the sea ice we have today in the Arctic Ocean, left everything the same. The temperature of the ocean water was the freezing point of seawater. And then he examined what changes it does for winter temperatures. And this is the change right here. This is how much it warmed in wintertime. And these are in centigrade, by the way. So right near the North Pole, it warmed 40 degrees centigrade, which is about 70 degrees Fahrenheit in the wintertime. And you can see in northern Siberia, 20 degrees centigrade, which is 38 degrees Fahrenheit. So Siberia and Alaska would be much warmer in the wintertime without that sea ice, just with the freezing temperature of the sea ice. But what if the freezing temperature of the ocean water. But what if the ocean water is 80 degrees Fahrenheit at the start? It'd be cooling rapidly, of course. Well, you're going to get much warmer temperatures in the wintertime. So Siberia is going to be much warmer and milder in the wintertime. It's going to be cooler in the summer, warmer in the winter, you see. It's cooler in the summer because of the volcanic ash reflecting the sunlight back to space, so you can't cool the land you cool the land better that way. So this is a radical change in climate resulting from our model for Siberia, Alaska, and the Yukon. Also, with that warm air, you have warm onshore flow, which would keep it warm from the Pacific as well as from the Arctic Ocean, keeping these areas warm. And that's why they were unglaciated in our model, because of the warmth up there. And there's lots of evidence for this warmth, by the way, in the fossil record. And this would help aid a lot of animals that can't tolerate much cold to round through the Bering Strait, as they call it, the Bering Land Bridge, which was dry land right after the flood, and come down into North America and Central America and South America. So this is a radically different climate from this model after the flood. So another question we need to ask before we talk more about how they died. So first of all, the warmth tells you how they live up there. If it wasn't so cold, there wouldn't be any permafrost. They can live up there. After a while, it becomes a grassland. I'll get into that. But there is another question. Do we have time in a 700-year ice age to account for millions of woolly mammoths up there? Is there enough time? Actually, there's plenty of time. Anyone done that geometric progression where you double, you hit 2 times 2 times 2? Well, after a short period of time, you're up into millions, or if not billions, and even more. Well, that's the way it works with the woolly mammoths. I went into the reproduction of woolly mammoths, or elephants, and it takes them 10 years before they can have an offspring, and they usually have one calf, sometimes two. So to simplify things, I just went to the information from African preserves, which are not ideal environments because there's poaching, and based on several preserves in Africa, I just found out the doubling time of elephants there. And one preserve, the doubling time was every 10 years. And in 10 years, you can have 1.3 billion in only 300 years. So we have lots of time. In our short time scale, we have plenty of time to reach millions of mammoths. The total, if you include Europe and North America, is probably around 50 million mammoths, I've estimated. So let's talk about the climate and the progression of the woolly mammoths, the woolly mammoth timeline, before I get into the demise. So, and kind of summarize it, at the beginning of the ice age, in this period right here, winters would be a lot warmer than today, and summers would be cooler than today. So you don't have much seasonal contrast. And this is why, this explains a lot of things. By the way, this is similar all over the world. This is just not Siberia. This explains a big mystery of the Ice Age, which I don't have time to get into, which is called disharmonious associations, where in a lot of places you have plants and animals that love the cold and love the warmth together in Ice Age sediments. And the only way you can get this is if you don't have any seasonal contrast or very little seasonal contrast. This is how it's explained, but they don't know how to get that. But our model gets that, you see. So we not only explain the Ice Age and the Woolly Mammoths, but there's a lot of other subsidiary mysteries associated with the Ice Age, like these disharmonious associations of plants and animals. The most outrageous one is hippos. In England, that were buried along with woolly mammoths and reindeer, hippos that love the warmth and the rain. This can be explained in our model, but I won't have time to go into it in the next talk. But anyway, this is one of these examples, and it can be explained by this lack of seasonal contrast. But with time, it's changing. It's a really dynamic climate change. Talk about your climate change. With time, everything the ocean cools off, so winters are going to get colder, summers are going to gradually get cooler, and finally, towards the end of the Ice Age, you get even colder than today. I drew this wrong. This should go down like this and then come up, because it's recovered. Since the end of the Ice Age, things have recovered some. So towards the end of the Ice Age, it'd be a lot colder. And that's where they were stressed. They weren't stressed when it was mild. And they weren't used to the cold. And that's one of the reasons why we had all these major extinctions around the whole Earth. Except for Africa, 80% of large animals went extinct. Large mammals and birds went extinct. And that's another major mystery, which we can explain by this model. And I won't have time to go into that. Let's talk about the moisture regime. With all that warm ocean water, and warming the air and evaporation, you're going to have pretty heavy precipitation at the beginning of the Ice Age up there. You're going to have trees growing, you know. And so I don't believe the woolly mammoths lived up there early in the Ice Age because it was forested. And there's evidence that it was forested in a warm climate in the fossil record. But then as time went on, it became cooler and drier and became more of a grassland. That's in the middle of the Ice Age. That's when the woolly mammoths lived up there. They came up there about during this period. And then it became drier and drier, and finally it really stressed them, and that's rarely when they went extinct, right in there. But things have improved since then. And this is the postulated area of permafrost. By definition, there wouldn't be any permafrost in freshly laid flood sediments, would there? So, in our model, we can explain the lack of permafrost up there by definition. No permafrost at the beginning. But with time, as winters cool more, it will slowly grow. In fact, by the end of the Ice Age, because it's colder and drier, the permafrost would be a lot more. And then with time, it melts. The top of it melts. And so that's why Siberia today is hills where it didn't melt, and then valleys with lakes and bogs where it did melt. And a lot of times you find concentrations of bones where it melted. So, and then you can have a woolly mammoth timeline. They're going to progress slowly, you know. But once they get started, their populations are going to mushroom. And as the climate becomes colder and drier and windier, as I'll talk about, they suddenly can't handle that climate, and they go extinct worldwide quickly by the end of the Ice Age. And during the Ice Age, all the animals and man can travel clear into North America, South and Central America through across the Bering Land Bridge. The Bering Sea is very shallow right in there, so they can cross into there through the lowlands not glaciated. And there's a nice free corridor along the east slopes of the Rockies, where I used to live for 27 years at Great Falls, about right in there. The Chinook winds, the downslope winds, dry it and warm it up in here. So the ice takes its time coming in there. Eventually the ice from this ice sheet, the Laurentide ice sheet and the Cordillon ice sheet, merged. So it blocked that. But for most of the Ice Age, animals and man can get through there. So let's get to the big question, which most of you are wondering, when is he getting to the point? I want to know how they and why they went extinct. So how did they die in Siberia? The key is the sediments they're buried in. That's the key to it. So you go to the experts that have dug them up in Siberia and find out what they're in. And Vereshchagin and comrade, I can't pronounce his name, said in 1999 in this book, a particular interest for the paleozoologists, those are those who study ancient dead animals in the fossil record, is the Odama. This is actually a Lurs, that's pronounced Lus by Americans and Lurs by Germans, is a German term. A Lurs layer, as a rule, containing the largest amount of remains of late Pleistocene animals. They're found in Lurs, or Lus. How many know what that is? It's windblown silt. Windblown silt. Ah! You know, that brings up a great way to explain all these mysteries. Windblown silt. And Dale Guthrie, in The Frozen Fauna of the Mammoth Steppe, a steppe is a dry, a wet spring, dry summer and fall. It's a grassland environment like the east slopes of the, like the high plains and east slopes of the Rockies. He says, like most of the Soviet Far East, large expanses of Alaska and the Yukon Territory and Siberia also were not glaciated during the Pleistocene. The Pleistocene is their name for the Ice Age period, by the way. Because these areas were bounded on several sides by enormous glaciers and glacial outwash streams, today much of Beringia, translated Eastern Siberia, Alaska, and Yukon, is mantled with a thick deposit of Aeolian, which means windblown, silt called Lurs. In other words, they're buried in silt, and there's lots of it, up to 200 feet thick in some places in river valleys where it would collect. Ah, windblown silt. So why would you get a lot of windblown silt during the Ice Age? See, they have lots of trouble explaining this, but in our model, the creationist model, we can explain it by the colder winters at the end of the Ice Age. A colder ocean. So with colder ocean, you have less evaporation and you have more sea ice, and that caps the evaporation, and a drier atmosphere. Also, you'd have strong north-south temperature differences. You have the ice sheets and the ice caps, and that would be cold, but the tropics would be warming, so that your north-south temperature difference would be very strong, a lot stronger than today, and that drives your jet stream. The stronger that is, the stronger the temperature differences, the stronger the wind. So you're going to have dry, windy, cold fronts going by that would have a lot of windblown silt, dust. So to learn more about the woolly mammoths, I studied the Dust Bowl era in the 1930s when suddenly the wind can be calm, suddenly a cold front come through. And whip up the dust, the visibility drops to zero. Now, I know in New Mexico you have a lot of these things, do you not? So you're kind of familiar with these. Do you have them here in Albuquerque, or are they in eastern New Mexico mostly? Some here. Yeah, I think they're mostly in eastern New Mexico. Anyway, these dust storms, the small to medium-sized dust storms, can explain the bones and tusks buried rapidly after undergoing natural decay, because you might put a layer that thick on it. Then you have another one maybe a week later that puts another layer. Finally, in a short period of time, you've covered up the bones and the carcasses that have rotted. So you can bury them rapidly in windblown silt. Also, you can explain why they end up in permafrost, because as you cover them up, you know, the permafrost, which is forming by the winter temperatures, is already there, and it comes up from the bottom up into the windblown silt that's deposited on top of the permafrost. You cool it from the top from the cold front too, but the permafrost comes up, you see, and the bones that are already there end up in the permafrost. Also, it explains why they're well preserved, because they're covered up fairly fast. So small to medium dust storms can explain the basic data up there. But what about the more exotic data? Like the one standing positions and the suffocation. Well, you know, they can be explained by huge dust storms. You had some dust storms were like blizzards in the Midwest that covered up fences and machinery and up and some barns. Like this might have been caused by one dust storm right here. I don't know whether it was or several or not, but I've heard that some, even a single dust storm during the Dust Bowl era would produce drifts like this. This has the potential to explain the other mysteries. Like, for instance, why they're stuck in a standing position. They got caught in a major dust storm, turned their back to the wind, and the dust packed around them. And so they died. They breathed the dust, suffocated. Explains the suffocation. And they died on their feet. And in a general standing position. It explains the frozen carcasses, because the permafrost comes up to meet them in the dust, as well as the cold front from the air coming down. So you have a fairly quick freeze, a moderate freeze. So the post-flood ice age model can explain these things. But there's two mysteries left. How do you explain the half-decayed stomach vegetation? And how are the broken bones explained? Well, to explain the half-digested vegetation, I went and did a little research on the digestion of elephants, which are similar to woolly mammoths, and found out that they have a different digestion system than cows and us. This quote from Gary Haynes in Mammoth, Mastodons, and Elephants says the digestive system is based on post-gastric, that's hindgut, fermentation. In other words, you don't digest the food in the stomach. It's digested after the stomach in the intestines and the cecum. And anyway, the stomach is large, but it serves mainly to store ingested food. Enzymes within the stomach partly break down the vegetation, but most nutrients are extracted in the huge cecum and large intestine where microbes ferment the food remaining after the gastric processing. This is similar to the digestion in a horse. And so the digestion doesn't occur in the stomach, but it's half decayed. And so if you freeze it fairly quick, we can explain this half-digested vegetation in those mammoths as well as the mastodons in the U.S. By just the digestive system of elephants. So I think this is a great possibility to explain the half-digested food. But what about the broken bones, especially the pelvis and ribs? I think the front leg bones could be broken by trying to get out of the dust that's packing hard around them. In fact, Larry Agenbrod said there's this place called Hot Springs, South Dakota, where there's a sinkhole there during the Ice Age where about 100 mammoths died in there, mostly Columbian mammoths. So he found a lot of them had broken limb bones. And so he only gives two possibilities, which in our situation in Siberia, only number one would be relevant. And that's torsional stress is provided by trying to extricate a limb mired in mud, muck, or quicksand. In other words, trying to get out of that windblown silt, he would shatter his limb bone, as the Barasavaca mammoth shows. But what about the rib and pelvis? Well, I discovered from a study of permafrost that permafrost faults and shifts. As Vereshchagin and his comrades said in that same book that I quoted, after burial in the permafrost, and the organic remains could have shifted vertically within a wide range owing to their physical properties and the features of the permafrost environment. It is now known that in frozen ground, bones and pieces of wood are sometimes shifted vertically by 10 to 15 meters, that's 30 to 50 feet, along boundaries of the frozen ground and ice veins. In other words, the shifting of the permafrost can break a thick limb bone of a woolly mammoth and ribs while in the permafrost. So I'm going to summarize all this with a series of cartoons. So if your eyes are glassy and you missed a lot of this, it's quick. This is very quick. If you want more information, I have some books on that. But here's a cartoon of summarizing all this. You have a woolly mammoth out there eating grass and buttercups, and, you know, calm, and suddenly the wind picks up. Uh-oh. The wind starts to blow, and it's dusty, and he turns his back. And the dust starts packing in. He's breathing it. He's suffocating. And if he's not totally covered, he's partially covered. He can't move, so he ends up in a generally standing position, suffocated. And finally, he ends up in the permafrost. And other dust storms totally cover the whole area until he's totally interred in the permafrost. I mean, the dust. The permafrost, which is that bluish area down below, which was already there, and comes up to meet him. And, of course, you have cooling from the air. And finally, he's totally interred in the permafrost. That's how you get him in the permafrost. And then you have fault and shatter the pelvis. So that's the summary of it. Why can't mainstream geologists see the importance of the LRS, the windblown silt? Why don't they see it? Well, it's because of their stretched out time scale. All this happens over tens of thousands of years, you see. So they know that about the LRS. And here's a quote from Verisch again, who's very generous in his estimates. One important factor was the fall of LRS on the cold, wet ground. However, this deposition can hardly have exceeded 2 to 3 centimeters, 1 inch. That's very generous. I mean, of course, that's its maximum. A year. At that rate, it would take 20 to 30 years to cover a mammoth, during which time the bones and tusks would have been almost entirely destroyed by atmospheric processes. So even this generous 1 inch would destroy these before they were totally covered. Dale Guthrie is much more reasonable. These large bones could not be preserved by a few millimeters of annual LRS, Aeolian LRS fall. The preservation requires large quantities of reworked silt. He gives it only a few millimeters, about the thickness of a dime, which is probably, that's even an exaggeration in that area today because they don't have much blowing silt in that area today. But, you know, so, and the reason is they stretch all this. But see, if we concentrate all that blowing silt, which in some places is 200 feet thick, into 100 years or 200 years, these dust storms became major factors for covering up these bones rapidly. They cannot see because of their stretched-out timescale, their uniformitarian beliefs, their worldview. Time is not a side issue, as some people think in this whole thing. It's crucial for solving major mysteries of the past. The short time scale is what I found. So, in summary, the post-flood rapid ice age accounts for the lowlands of Siberia not glaciated. Why mammoths even lived in Siberia, because it was not so cold in winter. It would also account for the abundance of food, because it eventually became a grassland. If there was a mix of warm and cold climate animals, it explains that because there was no seasonal contrast or little seasonal contrast at the beginning. It explains how mammoths and other animals went extinct at the end because it became cold, dry, strong winds and blowing silt, and probably fires also. It explains all the Siberian mysteries. In conclusion, reasonable explanations for the many mammoth mysteries are provided by the post-flood rapid ice age. This ice age is a climatic consequence of Noah's flood. This supports the Bible and is against the present processes over millions of years alternative model. So we have a great explanation for those mysteries. From our worldview, we can explain those things. They can't. That's the upshot of all this with our biblical worldview.